You're listening to the Brighton Book Club with Anna Burt on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM.
Hello and welcome to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM. It's a new show dedicated to all things literary and bookish in the city. You can get involved on Twitter using the hashtag Brighton Book Club, or you can email me at btnbookclub@gmail.com. On the show today, I'll be finding out about Spotlight Books, a new incentive between Myriad Editions, Creative Future and New Writing South. We'll have an interview with local author Emma Jane Unsworth about her new book Adults. And in the first instalment of the Brighton Book Club, we'll be talking about Lisa Tadeo's Three Women. I am delighted to be joined in the studio by my friend and author and screenwriter, Emma Jane Unsworth. Hi, Emma.
Hello, Anna.
Emma, instead of me introducing you, can you tell me a bit about yourself, please?
Okay. So I am a novelist and I write essays sometimes for magazines and newspapers. I'm kind of nervous to call myself a journalist because I've never been properly trained. I'm not like a proper journalist, but I sometimes write essays and things like that. And then I've just got into screenwriting. So I just adapted my second book into a film, and I'm hoping to do more of that kind of thing because I really enjoyed it.
Amazing. So we'll be talking about that more in a minute. But first, I'd like to understand your career as a whole, because I think people think that it's very easy to kind of write something, get an agent, get it published, and that it only happens to certain people at certain times. But I think there's so much graft that goes into it, and so much rejection, and so much writing that never sees the light of day. So it'd be really good to know kind of how you started and then how your career developed from there.
Sure. So so I studied English at university, first of all. I'm from Manchester, but I studied at university in Liverpool. And then I came back to Manchester and I did an MA in creative writing there, in novel writing actually specifically, which is a really great course. I'd really recommend doing writing courses because they just give you time and space to take it seriously rather than just thinking of it as a hobby. And also you're generally in quite a nurturing environment with other people who are in the same boat, so you can workshop stuff and it's really good. So I found that great. That was for couple of years, and during it was part time. And during that time, I was also a books editor at a local magazine that was kind of like the Manchester Time Out, called City Life Magazine. R.I.P. doesn't exist anymore.
Oh, no.
But it was great, and I got to be books editor there, so I got to write about books, which was sort of me finding my own voice and getting published, I suppose, in a bit of a public way. Even though it was book reviews about other people's books rather than my own fiction. But I did the course, and I finished a novel that part of the course was, well, part of the qualification was to finish a novel over the course of it. And it was a terrible novel, and it's on a floppy disk somewhere in landfill, which tells you how long ago this was. It was called Spider in the Glass, which is such a bad title.
It's kind of Bell Jar-esque.
Maybe that's what I was kind of riffing on. It sounds like some sort of gothic thing, doesn't it? But it wasn't. It was just about a girl wandering around bars in Manchester, funnily enough.
Was it autobiographical by any chance?
Yeah, right, what you know. So that has been condemned to obscurity, and there may it remain forever. But I do think that doing that course gave me just chance to find out what writing a novel involved, which is basically, as you said before, a lot of hard graft. Mm-hmm. And if there was one piece of advice, the best piece of advice I could give to anyone who wants to be a writer is just finish a draft of whatever it is you're working on, whether it's a short story, an article, a film or a book. Just get to the end of a draft, because otherwise you'll end up polishing the first five pages forever, and you'll just have these first five pages that are just kind of weirdly overwrought and overworked. You need to get to the end of the draft, and then from there you polish it as a whole and you know the shape of it. Even if it's dreadful, have a dreadful first draft that you can then work with and get help with as well once you've got an actual shape. So it gave me, it was helpful, of course, in just giving me experience of that and knowledge of that. And then I got into full-time journalism work, and I was unable during that time to write anything else really, other than a few short stories, because I just found that working at a screen all day made my eyes so fried and tired that by the time I got to the end of the day and got home, I just didn't want to put my eyes in front of another screen. I didn't want to open my laptop. So I struggled a bit, but then the the magazine that I was working for folded, I went over to the newspaper, and the newspaper then asked for voluntary redundancies, because this was all the big crisis in print that was going on with advertising, and all advertising was moving online, so they were asking for redundancies. So so I took it, and with that, because I'd been there sufficiently long enough, I got 6 months grace of kind of money, and that's when I wrote my first novel that got published, because I just needed that amount of time with nothing else to do to just focus. And I was like, right, that's my deadline, that's my time limit, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it. So so I did it, and then nobody bought it, nobody wanted it.
So Hungry the Stars and Everything, it was called.
That's right, yeah, yeah, that's right.
And were you sending out yourself? Did you have an agent at the time?
I had an agent who I'd got from, I had two friends who were already published, mm-hmm. and they, it was like a pincer movement, they got me in touch with this agent who really liked my stuff. And she sent this book, first book out, Hungry the Stars and Everything, and all the publishers turned it down, even the smaller publishers all turned it down. And I was heartbroken, mm-hmm. I kind of went under for a while, because that this was the thing that I'd taken time out to do, and I felt like I'd sacrificed time to do. And this was also the thing that I told myself I was always going to do and always going to be. I didn't really have a plan B. So it's like, oh, what am I going to do now? I can only really pull pints apart from this. I'm going to have to retrain or something. So so I sort of just took a bit of time, took a breath, you know, like a few weeks to just sort of allow this terrible sort of tragedy to wash through me, and just then pick myself up and carry on. And during that time, a friend of mine read the book, and she's a great friend of mine. She's called Sherry Ashworth, and she taught me English at GCSE. And then when I finished school, we stayed great friends, and she was like following my writing, and she was always a big supporter of me. And she said that when she retired, she wanted to set up a publisher's with her husband, who is also a retired teacher. And that's what they did. They set up a little publisher's called Hidden Gem, and she said, I want to publish your book. And I was like, oh wow, really? And she was like, yeah, I know it, and I love it, and I want to work with you. And so suddenly she snatched it then from like the jaws of defeat and put it out in the world. And it was such a small operation, because it was obviously she just set it up with her husband. We only printed a few hundred copies, mm-hmm. But I could just walk down the road to, she lived down the road from me, and I could just walk down the road and do the edits around her dining room table, and it was just so nice.
And then it becomes a pleasure again from a lot of pain, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And the book actually went on to be shortlisted for the 2012 Portico Prize, and also won a Betty Trask Award from the Society of Authors. So actually, screw every publisher that didn't believe in it. Did you feel a bit like that? You must have felt smart.
I did. Yeah, swanned around all those award ceremonies. And funnily enough, at those award ceremonies then, a few bigger publishers got interested then, and they sort of started asking, oh, what are you working on next? Mm. And so then I was in the very different position with my next book, of having one publisher, Canongate, one asking for a sneak preview before anyone else saw it. So we actually sent them, because Sherry had decided with Hidden Gems, she didn't want to publish anymore.
Okay.
She only wanted to do debuts and nothing immediately. So I was always going to be looking for sort of the next step up, if you like. Mm-hmm. So Canongate had asked to see a sneak preview of Animals, which wasn't called Animals then, it was called The Rogue, but they made me change it because they thought it was too masculine, but I kind of liked The Rogue. But anyway, Animals is better. Then they bought it off a small sort of like portion of it, off a partial, before it was even out. So that was like, rather than it doing the rounds and getting rejected by everyone, then it was another completely different experience of them just asking for a bit and buying it off that.
So then you had the power. And there's a massive difference, isn't there? So obviously Hidden Gem is a very small independent, and Canongate is still independent, yeah, believe it,
yeah,
or not.
Yeah.
But the experience must have been so different between the two of them. Could you talk a little bit about that? You know, what are the positives and negatives? You know, there are some obvious ones in terms of budget and outreach, but there must be some kind of smaller ones.
Yeah, I mean, just I suppose positives of working just with Sherry was that it was so lovely. It just felt like the two of us just sitting around a table making plans, and also taking it around libraries. We took it around every little library and bookshop in the north and in a lot of the country. And even though now that the thought of that exhausts me, because I have a 2-year-old, and I just think I wouldn't have the time and energy to do that now, but I was so up for it, and I was so hungry for it, and it just really felt like I'd just made contact with so many wonderful librarians, so many wonderful booksellers. It was so lovely and so sort of
grassroots,
completely, and that just felt really nice, and felt very, very intimate and in touch with people who were enjoying the book. And then I suppose with Canongate, the advantage immediately is that they have distribution to get it all over the country, which is just major. And then they also have access to festivals, got me on to loads of cool festivals, and then the publicity just went up to the next level. really. And as you say, they are independent, so there was still a lot of passion. And you know, you hear horror stories of writers getting lost in big companies, in big publishing mm-hmm. houses. They just, but that was never, you know, with Canongate, I always felt like everyone who worked there in every department of the company knew the book and loved the book and was working very hard for the book. And they're in Edinburgh, so it's really nice going up to Edinburgh and sort of having a good time there.
Have you ever done Edinburgh Festival?
Yeah, I have. Yeah,
it's just
yeah.
wonderful, isn't
it's
it?
Incredible. It's incredible. Yeah. It's so buzzy.
Okay, so we're going to be back with Emma in a minute. But in the meantime, we're going to play a song by someone who I know Emma loves as much as I do. This is Father John Misty with Real Love Baby. So Emma, your new book is coming out in early 2020.
It is.
Please, can you tell us more?
Yes. So it's coming out in January, actually. I keep saying it was February, but we've moved it forward. So it's January the 30th, and it's called Adults, and it's published by the Borough Press. And it's about a woman in her mid-30s who's having a huge crisis in every way. And she's spinning out on social media, and her mother's about to move in and mess things up even more. And her friendships are just a complete mess. And one of her friends is trying to break up with her, and she doesn't even realise it. And her career's going down the pan as well, so everything's going wrong for a poor thing. But she's pretty awful as well. She's got lots of lessons to learn.
There's this, I have to admit that I have read it and spoken to Emma a lot about it, and there's this amazing, one of my favourite scenes from it, which is one of the first scenes with the croissant.
Oh, yes.
Could you tell us a bit about that scene?
So it's about a character who's really, really neurotic and really, but also very entitled, kind of like an awful privileged woman, but who is having a dreadful time
and
inside herself.
And she's completely human as well. I think that's the thing. I think there are parts of her that we can all see parts of ourselves in, and she kind of vomits the things that we think and feel onto the page, and that's why it's so engaging.
I really wanted the challenge of writing a satire, because I think it is a satire as much as it's anything, but about a woman who is believable and real and messy and human and kind of splitting at the seams. But not, I mean, she's not always likable, but I hope she's always relatable, and I hope she's always believable. I hope she's always credible as a character, and that you just think, yeah, this person could exist, and I think, you know, I'm convinced by her. And she's funny. You see, that's her saving grace as well. She's really, Absolutely. Really
and
funny.
And also, so. She's self-aware.
Yeah, to a certain extent, there's
a part of her that kind of knows that she's kind of... is what she is. No, she's kind of awful, but then she has this level of self-awareness that she's kind of lost, especially in terms of her friendship. And that's something that I found really tragic in it, is when she just treats her best friend Kelly like her Instagram editor rather than her actual friend. And you know, there are times when you can tell as a reader that Kelly really needs her, and she just can't. She's got blinkers on.
Yeah.
She can't give it.
She's so blinkered, and she's so blind to so many things. And like in the scene with the croissant at the beginning, she's so obsessed with getting the right croissant from. She's queuing up in a coffee place, and she's picked the croissant that she wants from the tray, and she's so obsessed with getting that one. And there's one croissant on the tray that looks, you know, a bit of the wrong colour, and it's not sitting quite right.
Not Instagrammable.
It's not as Instagrammable. That's so true. And she's thinking, I don't want that croissant. I'm going to get that croissant. I don't want that croissant. I'm going to get that croissant. I have the right to not get that croissant. You know, all those kinds of thoughts. Mm-hmm. And of course, she gets that croissant. And this just sends her reeling and makes her react badly.
She kind of kicks off, doesn't she?
She does.
And doesn't she
does.
She posts an angry...
Yeah, she does. She posts an angry Instagram post about it. What an idiot. But something's gone wrong. She is traumatised as well, without wanting to give too much away. There's obviously something going very wrong with this woman, and that's partly why she has become this online monstrous version of herself.
The online stuff is really interesting, because we live in such an interesting online time, and we completely, you know, people can live their whole lives and their whole careers through Instagram, through Facebook, through Twitter, through YouTube. How did you kind of come to research the internet addiction part of the book?
I think I drew partially on my own worst experiences online. I know there have been times when I think I probably have a few addictive personality traits, even though I'm not an addict. But definitely there have been times when I've gone down the wormhole online late at night, usually at the end of a relationship or something like that,
okay.
when I've been
when
sad
vulnerable.
And lonely and vulnerable, and I've gone looking, probably as an act of self-torture in some way, looking for stuff that's going to make me hurt more, or, you know, just to justify my suspicions about something. And so I drew on all that to, I suppose, in a cathartic way, but also because I was fascinated by this very new way of communicating that we all have online. We can't ignore it. I didn't want to write a digital book. I really didn't want to write a digital book, but it just happened, because the second I started deconstructing this woman and this character and the way that she was spinning out, that just came in, and that just felt like the perfect way of showing, and the realistic way of showing,
Absolutely.
A person shattering and fragmenting across all areas of their life. Of course, this is going to feed the beast inside her, but it's also, she's going to be putting stuff out there as well in this very dishonest, inauthentic way.
Because you see it, don't you? I mean, you literally see it in front of you. I think that's why it's so relatable. And she is, Jenny McLean in the book, is obsessed with this woman on Instagram called Susie Brambles. And I spend so much time thinking about Susie Brambles because, actually, do you think this is okay for me to say?
Yeah.
I'm going to say it.
Let's do it.
So when Emma wrote one of the first or second drafts of the book, and I had a read, and I said, well, how fun would it be to create a fake Instagram for this character called Susie Brambles? So nearly 2 years ago in November, Susie's two-year anniversary.
Amazing. What should we do to celebrate? We should have an oat milk cortado on the beach.
Yes, with some matcha. So I started this. I don't use Instagram myself. I used to, and then I decided against it for many of the reasons that you said. I was not living a good life, and no one needed to see that on Instagram, basically. So I came off it. But I started again with Susie, which is great because I can spy on people.
Yes.
But also then just
you
be
get
Susie.
All the joys of Instagram, but none of the real emotional involvement.
Exactly.
It's perfect.
And it's kind of because every picture I post is actually my life, which is which kind of, you know, oh, look at this lovely oat milk smoothie I'm having. Because I am. I didn't buy it just for the picture.
So
it's a really
great.
It's a really fun.
But you do them in black and white because Susie does everything in black and white.
Everything's
monochrome because she's so cool and she's got so much integrity. Everything's monochrome.
She's very earnest. I think I really wanted to kind of take the mickey out of the earnest Instagram culture as well, you know, with all the and I love, don't get me wrong, I love yoga. I quite like vegan food despite not being a vegan, you know. I like nature, all the things that Susie likes, but it's kind of the way that people turn all these things that most people quite enjoy into something aesthetic that actually kind of makes other people feel less wholesome, I thought was really interesting. So if anyone's listening, follow at Susie Brambles, S-U-Z-Y, on Instagram for more great Susie content.
The Brighton Book Club with Anna Burt.
Welcome back to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM. That was Poem by US Girls, and I'm delighted to be joined in the studio by poet Lizzie Ridout. Hi, Lizzie.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on.
You're very welcome. So Lizzie's first collection of poetry was one of the winners of Spotlight Books, which is a Brighton-based collaboration between Creative Future, New Writing South and Myriad Editions to discover, guide and support writers who are underrepresented due to mental or physical health issues, disability, race, class, gender identity or social circumstance. Lizzie, can you tell me a bit about yourself and about your collection?
I would be absolutely delighted to. So my debut collection, published as part of the Spotlight series, is called Summon. It's been written over a period of several years. I've been writing since I was a teenager, then started winning various bits and pieces and doing a few slams here and there, and I got really into it. And this is my kind of first evolution in the printed world, which is amazing. It's sort of spurred on a little bit by a diagnosis of bipolar disorder, which I had a few years ago. But that's one of the things that kind of got it going. I try and kind of explore a few different ideas about voice in it, try on different personas, see how liberating that can be, and very much try and use this kind of personal narrative to explore bigger things. We live in a very split, divided society. I've always been very interested in binaries. The world is kind of in pieces, and I really like using the personal to explore the political, which I hope I try and do in this collection.
Would you read us one, please?
I'd be delighted to. So this poem is it's the last poem in the collection, actually. So it's called Wall. And it's probably one of the poems that best sums up this kind of way of moving between, hopefully moving between the personal and the political a little bit. So it's called Wall. I was a baby when the wall came down. I always felt such a rare harmony with it when watching its ugly smear at a distance of reels. Bipolar bear of Berlin waking up in the morning, one side or the other. Pale, tired east, slash, agitated, swashbuckling west. As hard to pin down as a gingerbread man. It's a swine when you're in the middle. I come of age in a time of walls. It fits, terrible as a spectrum. Balaclavas donned and Packard's thrown by the sleeping bag in the doorway. We are all cracking like scabs. I am Legion, the Cocteau siblings, Feckless Janice, and Martha and George all throw glasses in my frontal lobe. Aeneas at my right thumb, all hovering, lying in wait, dormant, crouching in the brain, in jelly, in fluid, to squirt from spongy nerves and confused glands, pouring through my frame of references. I would have been so happy to be the spider or the umbrella case, to sing in my sleep, to ward away Kishis or Edward Mordrake, depending on continent. Maybe then there would have been peace.
Thank you very much. That was amazing.
Thank you.
How has your bipolar diagnosis affected the way that you write?
So one of the ways in which it's affected the way that I write, first of all, it helped me make sense of quite a lot of things and contextualise a lot of things, mm-hmm. Which has been very useful. It's also kind of, I kind of like to see it, it's kind of a blessing and a curse in terms of writing, because it can make everything that you write looked at through that particular lens, but it can also be quite freeing because it makes you feel slightly fractured, which can be a good thing because it means you can try things on, explore the cracks in things, in yourself, in other people, in bigger ideas. So it's been kind of limiting in terms of perhaps perception, but it's been quite freeing in terms of different ways of trying things on and trying things out as a writer, actually.
Can you listen to music when you write?
Yes, I always listen to music when I write. So music is a huge source of inspiration to me. One of the reasons I got very into kind of participating in slams is I hang out with a lot of musicians and I had FOMO. I really wanted to kind of join in and have something that I could also say, oh yes, I'm doing this too. And so yeah, I listen to music all the time. I have lots of inspiration from different artists. Patti Smith is a huge influence on me. Kate Bush, David Bowie, loads and loads of different people. I really love Billie Eilish at the moment. She's fantastic.
So, she's amazing.
Yeah,
she?
I love her. She's great.
So we're going to play Rock and Roll Suicide now by David Bowie, which you asked me to play because you feel like it helps complement the collection and your feeling towards the collection. Could you give us a bit of an intro?
Yeah, so I've always been a huge Bowie fan, David Bowie. I love him, and I've always been really interested in his exploration of identity and the way he can transform himself. There's this real power in each of the personas that he embodies, and the fact that you can channel these different voices at different periods artistically and still be yourself really interests me, and I feel that that kind of is very evident in this collection. This particular song, I think, really speaks about feeling simultaneously disconnected and part of things. The line in it, "You're watching yourself, but you're too unfair." It really sums up. I love the line, but it also really sums up my collection for me. Weirdly, it's kind of terrifying, but compassionate, I hope, at the same time.
Thank you very much. Let's play it then. This is Rock and Roll Suicide by David Bowie. Welcome back to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM. I'm still joined in the studio by lovely Lizzie Ridout. Too many L's. whose collection of poetry, Summon, will be out in early January. Lizzie, I would love to know what the best advice you've ever been given as a writer is.
So the best advice I've ever been given as a writer, I've been given a lot of advice as a writer, and some of it is amazing, some of it's terrifying. The most useful, I think, is somebody once said to me that you should try and make the everyday strange, which I really love as an artist. It's a very kind of old sort of literary idea, but I love it because it kind of frees you up, but it also gives you something to work with. So write from things or to things. I think somebody once described the idea, you could describe a day at the beach, and if you did it from the perspective of a dropped ice cream cone, it immediately makes that very everyday thing that could perhaps become a cliche into something more interesting. So I think that that's probably the best advice I've ever been given, just making things as strange as possible. If it works, you've got a really great piece of writing. If it doesn't, you've done something to try and take control of the world you're looking at, and that's empowering. So it's win-win, really.
And what advice would you give to writers?
So I think the moment I kind of realised that I was actually getting somewhere when I was working on writing certainly a lot of stuff for this collection and other things, is that you should never feel frightened of stealing from yourself, which sounds strange, but basically always move things around, phrases, images, a line. If it doesn't work here, it might work in 6 months in something completely different. If it doesn't work in this particular format, you could move it into a prose poem or a short story, anything like that. So don't be afraid to kind of take your ideas and move them around a little bit. A lot of the poems I write, I kind of patch up from lots of bits and pieces, like a patchwork quilt, which I really love, like Frankenstein's monsters. And I find that a really helpful way of writing, and never throw anything away, always keep everything, because it's advice. Very useful to patch things up later on.
Thank you so much, Lizzie.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So can you tell anyone listening how they can read more of your work and where they can pre-order the collection?
So the collection and the other books in the Spotlight series, three poem collections and three prose works, are all available from Foyles, Waterstones, and directly from Myriad to pre-order. I have a blog. It's Elizabeth Ridout. Elizabeth spelled with a Z. Ridout, confusingly spelled R-I-D. OUT at wordpress.com, Elizabeth Ridout at wordcrux.com, and I also have a Twitter. So I am Lizzie, spelled Lizzy, Ridout, RIDOUT, and I love Twitter. I love blogging. Please reach out and contact me. That would be absolutely lovely.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And you're going to stick around to talk about Lisa Tadeo's Three Women.
Yes.
Which we will be talking about just after this next song.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM. It's a show dedicated to all things literary and bookish in the city. You can always get involved on Twitter using the Brighton Book Club hashtag. My Twitter handle is at Anna M. Burt, B-U-R-T-T. And you can email me at btnbookclub@gmail.com. So Lizzie Ridout is still in the studio with me today. And we're going to talk about Lisa Tadeo's book, Three Women. I'm going to read you the blurb. All Lena wanted was to be desired. How did she end up in a marriage with two children and a husband who wouldn't touch her? All Maggie wanted was to be understood. How did she end up in a relationship with her teacher and then in court, a hated pariah in her small town? All Sloane wanted was to be admired. How did she end up a sexual object of men, including her husband, who liked to watch her have sex with other men and women? Three Women is a record of unmet needs, unspoken thoughts, disappointments, hopes, and unrelenting obsessions. So Elle described it like a true crime story in which the crime is desire. And I absolutely couldn't agree more. And I've generously been given a clip by Bloomsbury, who's Lisa's publisher in the UK, with Lisa Tadeo herself talking about why she decided to focus on women rather than men as she originally planned when writing a book about desire.
There was complexity and beauty and violence, even, in the way the women experienced the same event. In these ways and more, it was the female parts of an interlude that, in my eyes, came to stand for the whole of what longing in America looks like. Of course, female desire can be just as bullish as male desire. And when desire was propulsive, when it was looking for an end it could control, my interest waned. But the stories wherein desire was something that could not be controlled, when the object of desire dictated the narrative, that was where I found the most magnificence, the most pain. It resembled pedaling a bicycle backward, the agony and futility, and, finally, the entry into another world altogether.
For me, Lisa Tadeo's story is one of the most candid depictions of female desire I've ever read. This book took her 7 years and countless trips across the USA, to find the women she wanted to speak to. A lot of what the book is about is told word for word, but the prose flows so smoothly. It's a kind of page-turning, thrilling book based on real people. I've never read anything quite like it. I've never read a book that talks about what women do want rather than what they don't want. And these are all women that are wildly judged by their communities for having and acting on their desires. There's so much shame in these stories, which is often the case when female desire is spoken about. Lizzie, what do you think of this book?
I loved it. I thought it was amazing. I thought it was frightening and yet vindicating at the same time. I loved the fact that there was this kind of very open discussion about these needs, these wants. All these things are driven by the desire to have a story, to have a narrative, all these kind of references to other books within it, all these different references to movies, all these kind of trajectories of desire that are following these stories of these women that are so personal and yet so relatable at the same time. And I also thought it was terrifying just because female desire has traditionally just been so kind of just vilified throughout history. It's something that, you know, it's becoming something that's talked about a little bit more, but it's very much, this book is very much an active thing. It's about the kind of active desires of women, but then their kind of subjugation to a passive role in dealing with the outcome of it. And that's sad but also wonderful that they were willing to share and express everything that they did.
It's absolutely amazingly detailed as well. And do you feel that it would be actually possible to write this as fiction, or do you think that the form as non-fiction was actually the only way that this could really be truly done?
I think so, and I think there's this kind of very lyrical quality to the book. It's beautiful, it's beautifully written, and I mean, creative non-fiction is becoming such a thing now for people, and I think it taps into this idea that people's everyday experiences can be poetic, can be beautiful, can be worth celebrating in this elegant way, and I think it works perfectly in that kind of setting. I think it's kind of treading this line between prose poetry and storytelling, and I think that's wonderful, and I think that fits really well with the subject matter as well. I think this idea that women's desires can be this kind of transmutable, kind of fluid thing, it kind of works so well with that slightly fluid, slightly kind of off-kilter way of narrating it as well, and I think the two things sort of go perfectly together.
So in the book, we've got three narratives. We've got Lena's, Maggie's and Sloane's. What one did you feel was the most powerful?
So I think they all were very powerful in their own way. I think the thing that was kind of most powerful across the three is this idea that they are from completely different ages, completely different social classes, have completely different life experiences, and they still kind of all kind of suffer this kind of fallout from following their own sort of sense of desire and need. I think the one that spoke to me the most probably was Maggie's story. Just because of the immediacy of it, the kind of the raw awfulness of the kind of clinical kind of breakdown of an inappropriate relationship with a teacher, with an authority figure, and then the kind of the fallout of that in the kind of legal sense, the kind of clinical, horrible, kind of judgmental part of that. It was just awful
and terrifyingly believable.
This is the thing. Mm. It was just so awfully. It was perfect. The precision of it was just terrifying. But it also kind of. I admired her character hugely. She had this kind of, this almost, it wasn't a hopeful kind of ending, but the power that she had to kind of try and take control of that process and to try and take control of what had happened to her and what she had acted upon. I think it was an inspiring thing. I thought it was wonderful.
Absolutely. And that is all we've got time for today on the book club. But I just want to say a big thank you, Lizzie, for joining me
in the
studio.
Thank you so much.
And good luck with Spotlight Books.
Thank you. It's been great.
Will you come back and tell us about it in the new year?
I would be delighted.
Excellent. So next month in the Brighton Book Club, we're going to be talking about Leonard and Hungry Paul by Ronan Hessian, which is a book published by Blue Moose. Have you read it? Would you like to? Now is your chance, because lovely team at Blue Moose have kindly donated me three copies to send to three listeners who want to get involved in the next show. Email me at btnbookclub@gmail.com or tweet me at Anna M. Burt, B-U-R-T-T, or use the hashtag Brighton Book Club to be in with the chance of getting a copy. And if you're reading it, tweet me, tell me what you're thinking. Next month, we're also going to be having a Christmas gift guide from Elizabeth at City Books in Hove. So if you're not sure what to buy your loved ones for Christmas this year, we're going to have suggestions for your mums, your dads, your brothers, your sisters, your friends, and for you. The emerging author we're going to have on the show is Tamye Huff, whose debut novel tells the story of her great-great-grandparents during the slavery era in America. We're also going to be having Amanthi Harris on the show, author of Beautiful Place, which is recently published by Salt. A couple of things more before I wrap up this month, and I'm very sorry if you're hearing this on repeat and these events have passed, but we've got a few really good things coming up in the city. On October the 30th, there's a free event at Sussex University on radical feminist and black publishing with a legendary Margaret Busby. Local publisher Myriad Editions' next literary salon is a collaboration with City Books and features Robin Ince in conversation with Daryl Cunningham, and that's at the Knighting Rooms on Sunday, November the 3rd from 1:30 till 3:30. And a bit of shameless self-promotion here. On November the 16th, I'm running a one-day writing retreat at the West Hill Hall in Seven Dials. The last one that I ran over the summer was a real success, if I say so myself, and brought together a group of Brighton writers to set goals and work towards them with lots of tea, coffee and delicious lunch. If you'd like to know more, you can find a link on my Twitter page or Google westhilldayretreat.eventbrite.co.uk. I'd like to thank Nigel at the Flying Saucer, which is the lovely cafe at the Open Market, for providing us with some delicious food and drink today. As always, I'd like to hear from you. Are you a writer in the city? Have you read something great recently? What do you think our book club book should be in December? We want to hear your suggestions, so get in contact on Twitter using the hashtag. There's going to be a new episode every month played throughout the month, and also available as a podcast with extra content for you to download. This month will feature Emma Jane Unsworth talking about adapting animals to a screenplay. Thank you for listening, and thank you to lovely Ben at Radio Reverb. We'll see you next month.